Subheading: O Daniel, you very desirable man. In the 8th chapter, Daniel received a vivid vision of a violent clash between a two-horned ram and a hairy he-goat with a unicorn-like great horn, which was subsequently broken off and replaced by four lesser horns, one of which sprouted a small horn that kept getting greater and greater, all the way to challenging the prince of the army. But Daniel was not a mere passive observer. The prophet encountered two divine beings in the vision, with whom he interacted. One unnamed entity apparently remained invisible and did not speak directly to Daniel. But the prophet heard his commanding voice emanating from the middle of the river, where Daniel was standing on the bank in the vision. The unseen angel then commanded another angel, named Gabriel, to approach Daniel and explain to him the meaning of the vision he had seen. But Daniel collapsed as the angel approached him and became as if he were asleep. The messenger gently awakened him and caused him to stand erect on his feet. Afterwards, Gabriel went on to relate to him the significance of the vision, how it was a vision for the time of the end. Daniel was specifically instructed to make secret what he had seen. Daniel's encounter with the two angels, the unseen angel apparently representing the great prince, Jesus Christ, is pictorial of how the holy ones will be enlightened during the actual time of the end, as was Daniel on that occasion. Even though Daniel could not understand how the vision would actually become reality, the angel did explain to him what the various symbolism represented. In that respect, Daniel represents the holy ones, who will be on hand during the time of the end, when the prophecy will finally be unsealed. The fact that Gabriel was under the command of another spirit greater than himself pictures Jesus sending forth his angels to minister to and gather the chosen ones. But as extraordinary as the experience was, Daniel had yet another encounter with an angel that was even more dramatic. This occurred in the third year, after Babylon had fallen to Cyrus. Significantly, after the fall of Babylon, Daniel began to discern from the writings of Jeremiah that the time had arrived for the repentant Jews to be set free from their captivity and for the holy place in Jerusalem to be restored. The 9th chapter is a record of a prayer Daniel uttered in behalf of the Jews, confessing their sins before God and humbly requesting for Jehovah to restore his favor to his people. In the 10th chapter, 2 years later, Daniel was fasting and humbling himself before God, and it was on that occasion that Daniel had a startling vision of a supernatural man. Daniel described the experience this way: I also proceeded to raise my eyes and see, and here was a certain man clothed in linen, with his hips girded with gold of Uphaz, and his body was like chrysolite, and his face like the appearance of lightning, and his eyes like fiery torches, and his arms and the place of his feet were like the sight of burnished copper, and the sound of his words was like the sound of a crowd. And I saw, I, Daniel, by myself, the appearance. But as for the men that happened to be with me, they did not see the appearance. However, there was a great trembling that fell upon them, so that they went running away and hiding themselves. And I was left remaining by myself, so that I saw this great appearance. And there was left remaining in me no power, and my own dignity became changed upon me to ruination, and I retained no power. And I began hearing the sound of his words. And while I was hearing the sound of his words, I myself also happened to be fast asleep upon my face, with my face to the earth. And look, there was a hand that touched me, and it gradually stirred me to get up upon my knees and the palms of my hands. And he proceeded to say to me, O Daniel, you very desirable man, have understanding in the words that I am speaking to you, and stand up where you were standing, for now I have been sent to you. And when he spoke with me this word, I did stand up, shivering. What is the significance of the appearance and the fact that the manifested spirit addressed Daniel three times as a very desirable man? There's no question that the appearance Daniel saw was a vision of the glorified Christ, the essential features of the vision being very similar to what John experienced when he received the revelation. For example, Revelation 1:12-17 relates, And I turned to see the voice that was speaking with me, and having turned, I saw seven golden lampstands, and in the midst of the lampstands, someone like a son of man, clothed with a garment that reached down to the feet, and girded at the breast with a golden girdle. Moreover, his head and his hair were white as white wool, as snow, and his eyes as a fiery flame, and his feet were like fine copper when glowing in a furnace, and his voice was as the sound of many waters. And he had in his right hand seven stars, and out of his mouth a sharp, long, two-edged sword was protruding, and his countenance was as the sun when it shines in its power. When I saw him, I fell as dead at his feet. As already pointed out, both Daniel and John were in a captive condition to the empire of the beast when they received the visions. Both prophets were also quite aged. This would seem to picture the entire body of anointed Christians on earth during the parousia, who are also aptly symbolized as elderly men, since most are quite old too. The holy ones will also find themselves in captivity to the same seven-headed political monstrosity that once held Daniel and John captive. By those means, Christ will chastise the faithful slave with a symbolic lash of humiliation and hardship. And toward the end of the three-year period, the greater Cyrus will then liberate God's people. Daniel's experience is a portent of the visible manifestation of Christ to the holy ones during the time of the end. The chosen ones are indeed very desirable to Jehovah, so much so that Jesus said that the chosen ones personally have an angel that always has direct access to the face of Jehovah himself. They are desirable because Jehovah has chosen to lavish his rich blessings upon them, making them sharers of Christ's heavenly nature. That is why the angel stated that Daniel was a very desirable man. He pictures the chosen ones during the parousia. Although neither Daniel nor John actually saw Jesus Christ, their experiences being merely visions, as Saul the Pharisee, the Apostle Paul evidently had an actual glimpse of the glorified Christ, the only human ever to do so. The significance of that encounter on the road to Damascus is that Saul's companions did not see a sight, as did Saul. Neither did Daniel's companions see the flaming apparition. However, they fled, trembling, sensing the invisible presence of some great thing not of this world. This signifies that the spiritual companions of the chosen ones will not see the manifestation of Jesus Christ directly. Another interesting aspect is this. Daniel and Paul had not expected to have such a rapturous experience. The sudden appearance from out of the invisible was not by appointment. It was not something they were anticipating. In the same way, anointed Christians today do not expect to see Christ while they are in the flesh. That is because they were laboring under the watchtower's powerful delusion of an invisible parousia. So, the visible manifestation of the Lord to them will undoubtedly have a jarring effect. But just as Daniel was assisted to his feet by the glorious Lord, and John was exhorted not to be afraid by the Christ he saw in vision, the chosen ones will be infused with power and recover their dignity after they are terrified by their startling encounter with the glorified Christ. Afterwards, they will shine like the brightness of the expanse, like the stars, to time indefinite, even forever. Subheading: The Prince of the Royal Realm of Persia. In both instances that Daniel interacted with angels, the spirits had been dispatched to the prophet to reveal matters destined to occur during the final part of the days in connection with the king fierce in countenance and the king of the north. At Daniel 10:1, the prophecy of the kings of the north and south is summarized thusly: In the third year of Cyrus, the king of Persia, there was a matter revealed to Daniel, whose name was called Belteshazzar. And the matter was true, and there was a great military service, and he understood the matter, and he had understanding in the things seen. What is the great military service? It must refer to the final conflict between the two earthly kings, designated as the king of the north and king of the south. That conflict will set the stage for the final scene, the grand finale, the ultimate confrontation between the earthly kings and the Prince of Princes, the King of Kings, and the Lord of Lords, Jesus Christ. The parallel prophecy of the king fierce in countenance must likewise be understood in the framework of a great military conflict. But in truth, the great military service will not merely be an earthly war theater. It is a universal war, with the real theater of conflict in a realm invisible to human eyes. As revealed in the 10th chapter of Daniel, what is the significance of the fact that the prince of the royal realm of Persia successfully opposed the angelic messenger who had been dispatched to enlighten the prophet? Obviously, no human prince could possibly resist a mighty angel of Jehovah. That being the case, the prince of Persia must be a demonic resister. The spirit opposer was finally overcome when Michael came to the angel's assistance. Think of the implications, though. This means that Daniel was kept in an unenlightened state regarding events to occur in the final part of the days due to fierce demonic resistance. This drama that was played out in the heavenly sphere certainly explains why the watchtower, and consequently Jehovah's Witnesses, are in such a befuddled state today when it comes to understanding prophetic matters. As in the case of Daniel, the enlightening angel will not make a breakthrough until Michael comes and overpowers Satan and his fellow resistors. This aspect of Daniel also mirrors the 12th chapter of Revelation regarding the warfare that is destined to erupt in the spirit realm when Michael and his angels battle with the devil and his angels, with the seed of the woman, a Daniel class, if you will, being caught in the crossfire when the maddened demon princes bring woe upon the earthly system. The significance of the series of prophecies in Daniel is they establish the fact that God's kingdom comes into direct conflict with a specific earthly government at a certain moment in time, brought on by a conflict in heaven and reflected in a series of political developments culminating with the martyrdom of the final sons of God. the prophecy in the 8th chapter of Daniel concerning the small horn that emerges from the hairy he-goat and which becomes greater and greater also sheds light upon the rise and fall of the last kingdom. Subheading: There will stand up a king fierce in countenance. The angel explained to Daniel that the king fierce in countenance arises from competing factions that had their origin with the breakup of Alexander's sprawling Grecian empire. Daniel, the 8th chapter, does not cover any of the detailed history that the 11th chapter relates from the time of Alexander's death. Instead, Daniel 8:23-25 picks up the final developments of the ongoing struggle for supremacy. And in the final part of their kingdom, as the transgressors act to a completion, there will stand up a king fierce in countenance, and understanding ambiguous sayings, and his power must become mighty, but not by his own power. And in a wonderful way he will cause ruin, and he will certainly prove successful and do effectively. And he will actually bring mighty ones to ruin, also the people made up of the holy ones. And according to his insight, he will also certainly cause deception to succeed in his hand. And in his heart he will put on great airs, and during a freedom from care he will bring many to ruin. And against the Prince of Princes he will stand up, but it will be without hand that he will be broken. The final part of their kingdom, plural, evidently refers to the Anglo-American dual world power. It is an established fact that the modern world of extended European civilization can trace its cultural and philosophical roots back to ancient Greece. Paradoxically, the two antagonistic systems of oligarchism and republicanism embodied in the hybrid Anglo-American system are antagonistic ideologies that both existed in ancient Greece. So, while Greece is known as the cradle of democracy and republicanism, Alexander's empire is also the forerunner of the Roman and British empires as well. This striving of two competing kings is in harmony with what is also related in Daniel concerning the struggle between the kings of the north and south, as well as the incompatible iron and clay amalgam that do not stick together. It perfectly symbolizes the modern Anglo-American dual world power, which is an unnatural union of imperialism and republicanism. But as noted previously, one force wins out. Apparently, then, the king fierce in countenance is the champion of the empire. Indeed, the little horn from which the last horn grows greater and greater must be the British Empire, which the prophecy indicates will morph into a great global empire during the final part of the days. Subheading: Understanding Ambiguous Sayings. The American Standard Bible happens to render the verse, "Understanding Dark Sentences." But what might these dark sentences or ambiguous sayings be? The Watchtower has never offered a satisfactory explanation in any publication as to how the king fierce in countenance may understand ambiguous sayings. Nevertheless, in view of the fact that the primary political phenomenon in recent decades has been the subtle yet irresistible drive towards globalization, the relentless propaganda campaign behind that movement deserves some consideration. It is undeniable that society has been saturated with a peculiar variety of politically charged, ambiguous sayings that are mere euphemisms for world government. Terms like New World Order, One World, Free Trade, Global Governance, Internationalism, Environmentalism, and Economic Liberalism are all common terms. But what do they really mean? Our modern lexicon has many somewhat ambiguous terms related to globalism. So, what is globalization all about? Globalization is not a new phenomenon. It began during the 19th century under the guiding hand of the British Empire. Most people understand globalism as merely opening up new economic markets. However, many observers have come to understand that the intent behind the ambiguous political parlance has to do with conditioning and propagandizing society, with the goal of ultimately abolishing the sovereignty of individual nation-states and empowering the UN to serve as a world government. For a certainty, as discussed in the chapter The King of the North, the circle of great men associated with the British crown have for many decades been pursuing the goal of reinventing the empire in the form of a UN-controlled world government. To that end, numerous intermediate treaties and international organizations have already been advanced. For example, the World Trade Organization came into existence in 1995 for the purpose of forcing nations to keep their markets unregulated by protectionists. Opponents charge that the WTO undermines national sovereignties. The European Union appears to be a major step towards ensnaring the individual nations of Europe into ceding over a significant portion of their sovereignty to an international body, particularly with respects to national currencies. The nations that have adopted the euro have to abide by strict budgetary restraints that are usually against the interest of the nation in order to comply with the European Central Bank dictates. And now the nations of Europe are being induced to accept the latest version of the Lisbon Treaty, which is seen by nationalists as an outright dictatorship. In every case where international bodies and/or the interest of multinational corporations are advanced to supersede the authority of national governments, the unseen hand of the financier oligarchy may be perceived operating behind the scene. The fact is, ever since the United States broke away from the British Empire, private financial interests have been determined to undermine control and ultimately destroy the republican form of government. So it is that the King of Fierce Countenance understands these baffling and ambiguous sayings having to do with a new world order, and that he is the secret source of the propaganda intended to totally bring the world under his imperial yoke. The very fact that numerous supranational organizations are gaining power over the nations may well be a manifestation of the power of the little horn growing greater and greater. Interestingly, the New International Version renders Daniel 8:23 this way: "In the latter part of their reign, when rebels have become completely wicked, a stern-faced king, a master of intrigue, will arise." A master of intrigue well describes the masterful way the London-centered financial oligarchy have persuaded entire nations to adopt policies that are against their own interests. It is also well known, for instance, that as a matter of policy, powerful banking interests loan money to both sides during a war and have also been the unseen power brokers behind communism. Intrigue indeed! Subheading: His power must become mighty, but not by his own power. The defunct League of Nations notwithstanding, and acknowledging that the EU is merely a regional government only, the United Nations is the only organization that is capable of becoming a world government. But unlike national governments, the United Nations has no nation of people or national group as its power base. The UN derives its power and authority solely from the consent of all its member nations. while primarily a creation of the Anglo-American dyad, to the extent that each nation relinquishes a portion of its own sovereignty, and to the degree that each nation contributes funds, military equipment, and personnel, to that extent the United Nations is empowered. Ultimately, though, the power behind the UN is the financier oligarchy, the very same monopolies behind the British Empire. However, it is apparent that the UN does not presently possess the power or authority to destroy organized religion, as Jehovah's Witnesses anticipate. Yet the Word of God assures us that at some point the Eighth King will receive a full grant of authority from all the kings of the earth, symbolized by 10, even as the Scripture says. And the 10 horns that you saw mean 10 kings, who have not yet received a kingdom, but they do receive authority as kings 1 hour with the wild beast. These have one thought, and so they give their power and authority to the wild beast. In other words, the eighth king will become mighty, not by his own power, but due to the power of all of earth's kings who give their power and authority to the wild beast. The 10 kings who have not yet received a kingdom may symbolize all the nations that will fully empower the beast. The Bible thus interprets itself, indicating that the king of fierce countenance and the eighth king are identical. It should not be supposed, though, that the nations might give up their sovereignty without coercion. When organized religion is eventually annihilated by the eighth king, the prophecy says that even the kings of the earth, who originally gave their power to the eighth king, will stand at a distance because of their fear of her torment and say, "Too bad, too bad, you great city." Under the circumstances of global catastrophe and international crisis, it does not take a great deal of imagination to envision the UN acquisitioning the world's armies and even nuclear weaponry, so that no individual nation would dare challenge its power. In this way, the King Fierce in Countenance must become mighty in power. The newly elected Barack Obama has expressed his desire to enhance the cooperation between the American superpower and the United Nations. The President also announced his intention to reduce nuclear arms. Perhaps under extraordinary circumstances, the United States and Great Britain may even advocate turning over their vast arsenals to the control of the United Nations. As stated previously, there is a scheme afoot to have the UN issue some form of global currency as an alternative to the U.S. dollar, continuing to serve as the world's reserve currency. The IMF, a supranational agency created at the same time as the United Nations, has already begun issuing its own bonds in the form of special drawing rights. Under the guiding hand of London, China has quietly begun to offload its nearly $2 trillion U.S. Treasury's portfolio in favor of IMF-issued debt. Considering that Daniel 11:36 also says the King of the North will certainly prove successful until the denunciation will have come to a finish, it may rightly be concluded that the final manifestation of the King of the North and the King of Fierce Countenance are the same entity, and that the last king will succeed in sinking the American-led, democratic, nation-state system. The King of Fierce Countenance also apparently comes out of the symbolic North. Daniel 8:9 says, "And it kept getting very much greater toward the south, and toward the sun rising, and toward the decoration." Expanding his empire south, and toward the sun rising, east, and toward the decoration, evidently west, the prophecy seems intended to indicate that the King of Fierce Countenance comes from the north and expands his dominion in all directions to envelop the entire globe. This harmonizes with the many Hebrew prophecies that foretell a tyrant will come upon the world from out of the symbolic north. Isaiah, the 25th chapter, refers to the town of tyrannical nations, saying that the persecution from it is as a scorching heat, and as when the blast of the tyrannical ones is like a rainstorm against a wall. Furthermore, in that context, Isaiah 25:7 indicates that God will intervene and that he will swallow up the face of the envelopment that is enveloping over all peoples and the woven work that is interwoven upon all the nations. The envelopment that is enveloping over all peoples and enmeshing all the nations has to do with the imposition of a globe-strangling, tyrannical regime. That Jehovah would use that setting to speak of his doing away with death and wiping the tears from the eyes of his people is an indication of the horrors yet to be unleashed when the King of Fierce Countenance succeeds in causing widespread ruination. Subheading: He will bring mighty ones to ruin. The period following World War II has been a time of relative peace and prosperity, generally speaking. In the Western nations, at least, the children born in the post-war era, the so-called baby boomer generation, have not known the hardships of their parents and grandparents, who lived through the First World War, the Great Depression, and the Second World War. Post-World War II generations have become accustomed to the idea that nothing will ever change. Contributing to the popular delusion, the 1990s saw a period of money mania on a scale not seen since the high-flying Roaring Twenties, which, of course, ended with a thud in the Wall Street crash of 1929. So it has become the general expectation, cultivated by the world's most vocal experts and pundits, that everything will continue on as in recent times. However, God has envisioned an entirely different fate for this wicked system of things. Jehovah's prophets foretell that at some point men will become so desperate that they will throw their worthless money into the very street. Actually, such a thing is not so far-fetched at all, considering what happened in Weimar, Germany in 1923. Due to vicious war reparations imposed on Germany by the Treaty of Versailles, the Weimar government tried to print its way out of debt. As a result of vastly inflating the money supply, in a few short months, the national currency was destroyed due to hyperinflation, so that it became completely worthless. Those who were wealthy, and whose wealth was held in paper Reichsmarks, were brought to ruin. Since the so-called credit crunch began in 2008, the United States Federal Reserve and the Treasury have loaned, pledged, or bought worthless paper from the bankrupt banks and hedge funds, amounting now to over $20 trillion and counting. In recent months, it has been reported that the central bank is even buying trillions in U.S. treasuries, too, in order to forestall the collapse of the U.S. debt market. All of this money pumping is ominously reminiscent of Weimar Germany. To underscore the antagonistic relationship between private financial interests and the people of the nations, the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank, which, as already stated, is a privately held bank controlled by other banks with anonymous shareholders, has been ordered by the court to disclose the recipients of some $2 trillion of bailout monies, which the Fed has so far refused to do. Empires have always sustained themselves by means of looting and pillaging. The empire of the financiers has succeeded in plundering in a wonderful way by deceiving the political leaders into allowing financiers to control the economies of nations. The trend of deregulation has succeeded in allowing what was once the world's most prosperous nation to be looted to the bone. Taxpayers have even been bamboozled into paying trillions to make good the plunderers' bad gambling debts. Now, though, the monetarist system has itself reached the point of implosion. At this late date, the fate of nations lies with the decisions politicians in the United States must make in the immediate days ahead. The decision before them is whether to allow the unpayable and largely fictitious financial claims of the London Wall Street Empire to continue to drag the nations into complete and utter ruin. The other choice before the leaders is to shut down the financier system for the preservation of nations. The two inimical systems can no longer coexist in the same world. What will be the outcome? Prophecy reveals that the mighty ones of this world are about to be brought to ruin in a wonderful way when the king, fierce in countenance, detonates the debt bomb and then forecloses on the world. Subheading: He will cause deception to succeed. Needless to say, Satan's entire wicked world is run from the top down based on deception. Therefore, those most adept at deceiving others often succeed in this world. While many people will admit that government leaders, politicians, businessmen often lie to the public, few people are mentally up to the challenge of accepting that there is such a thing as a conspiracy to destroy the nation-state system of things and enslave the world in tyranny. But judging from the masterful way in which the nations have already been ensnared in a web of debt foisted upon them by financiers, from which they have so far been unable to extricate themselves, it is undeniable that the nations have been deceived by very clever manipulators. Such will become horrifyingly obvious when the trap is finally sprung. A pervasive lie is that the world is overpopulated. A British statistician by the name of Thomas Malthus, who was apparently commissioned by the British Empire, first advanced this notion back in the 18th century, before the world's population even reached 1 billion. His name has since become synonymous with population reduction. Hence, Malthusianism has been the cornerstone of imperial policy up to the present day. In fact, since 1974, it has been the official policy of the Anglo-American establishment to reduce third world population by whatever means is available, in order to make sure that third world resources are available to the wealthier nations. This policy was codified in a recently declassified document called NSSM 2000. Not surprisingly, the United Nations is on the forefront of population reduction. Contrary to popular opinion, though, the world is not overpopulated. It is merely underdeveloped. And again, the empire is determined that undeveloped nations stay that way. To that end, environmentalism is an effective tool for those in a position to carry out the British Empire's depopulation scheme. Judging from the progress that has been made so far, it is apparent that the power behind the soon-to-come-on-the-scene King Fierce in Countenance has shown great insight into human nature, as well as into political and financial matters. The imperial-minded king has thoroughly deceived the nations as to the nature of his intentions. Behind the seemingly benevolent facade of a peacekeeper and of protecting human rights, trying to save the planet from war, poverty, and ruin, the United Nations stands poised to become the instrument to hamstring the nations and implement the oligarchy's agenda of reducing the Earth's population by as much as 80%. Since, according to Habakkuk, the last king is the agency that Jehovah has assigned to punish the nations, evidently the last empire will fully implement a policy of global genocide at some point during the world's nightmarish last hour. It is a fitting end for a world that will resolutely refuse the loving hand of its own Savior. The stern-faced king will not only succeed in deceiving and ruining the mighty ones of the world, but he will also have success in conquering the holy ones. Daniel 8:11-12 foretells, "And all the way to the prince of the army it put on great airs, and from him the constant feature was taken away, and the established place of his sanctuary was thrown down, and an army itself was gradually given over, together with the constant feature, because of transgression. And it kept throwing truth to the earth, and it acted and had success." It is vital to note that Christ has an established place on earth that serves as a temple for the worship of his Father. What is the established place of his sanctuary that will be thrown down during the time of the end? Did not Jesus also foretell that the holy place would be desolated by a disgusting abomination? According to the writings of the apostles, the sanctuary, or temple of God, is composed of the body of anointed Christians themselves. It is simply the congregation of Christ. How might the king fierce in countenance find success in throwing truth to the earth? That remains to be seen. But already the empire has laid the groundwork for a massive deception operation. Nearly 200 years ago, London concocted Zionism as a geopolitical and religious scheme. Since then, Zionists have promoted the notion that the creation of an Israeli state is a prerequisite for the return of Christ. Millions of evangelicals earnestly believe that Israel must be protected at all costs. It is quite likely that nuclear war will erupt in the Middle East during the conclusion, further deceiving the deluded masses into believing that Christ is somehow fighting for Israel. But the authentic Israel of God and the holy place are connected to the people who bear the name of Jehovah. Since the last king comes on the scene at the same time Jesus Christ arrives in his kingdom to commence his parousia, the last king has the ignominious distinction of being the only earthly government to rule in direct opposition to the kingdom of God. That will make it a disgusting thing in God's sight. Because the holy ones are the earthly representatives of the invisible kingdom of heaven, Satan will inevitably maneuver his earthly kingdom to suppress the voice of Christ's representatives too. Hence, the disgusting thing will begin standing in a holy place when the last empire moves to suppress Jehovah's Witnesses and destroy the Watchtower Society. The king of fierce countenance will then find himself in the middle of the battlefield of Armageddon, where he will prove to be no match for Jesus Christ and his legions of angels. That is when the curtain rises for the finale. Daniel 8:25b writes the final sentence to the last chapter of the history of the empire of man. It reads, "And against the prince of princes he will stand up, but it will be without hand that he will be broken."